he has. And I think that thesis on this really ought to reach the light of day as a publication in the sometime not too distant future. Gregory Nazianzen is one of my personal saints. I have great affection for him, and he's the great poet of the ancient church. And I have just returned from Turkey, where I actually was at his church, and down in the baptistry, and walking in the caves that surround it, where the monastics lived for quite a number of years. There are so many things about him that are charming. My personal favorite, I suppose, is that when he became Archbishop of Constantinople, he got so fed up with the politics that he left one night by the back door, never to be seen again, without telling anybody where he was going. And he ended up going down to where I was and hiding out for a period of time with Basil the Great. They're considered great friends, but as near as I can tell, they never really got on all that well. They're kind of like Peter. Pardon?
Frenemies.
Yes, frenemies, yeah.
Frenemies.
Kind of like Peter and Paul. You know, in the Eastern Church, we have the Feast of Peter and Paul, and there's an icon showing them together, and I point out to people they were never photographed together. But I'm delighted you're here, Jeremy, and that you're going to speak to this theme. Jeremy's in Calgary, working at the Mustard Seed in Calgary, really working out of the kinds of concerns that he's going to speak about today. So, welcome. Thanks. Glad you're here.
Thanks for the intro, David. Just for, I guess, a little background on Julian and Gregory. Julian was a nephew of Constantine, and he was born around 331 and became emperor in 361, but was only in office for less than 2 years because he was killed in battle. And he's often referred to throughout history as the apostate, since he left his Christian roots for pagan Hellenism. And Gregory Nazianzen, some people say Gregory of Nazianzus, I say Gregory Nazianzen just because it's easier to say, it's one less syllable. He was born about the same time, and he's known as one of the great theologians from the Roman province of Cappadocia, along with Basil of Caesarea, Basil's brother Gregory of Nyssa, and their often neglected sister Macrina. The Cappadocian fathers are most famous for their significant impact on Trinitarian theology during the 4th century Nicene and Arian controversies. So there's a lot of connection between Gregory and Julian. They both were raised as Christians. They both considered themselves philosophers. They both studied literature and rhetoric in Athens at the same time. And they both eventually found themselves in prime positions of leadership, Julian as emperor and Gregory as Archbishop of Constantinople. And they were both prolific writers, trained in the skills of rhetoric. And they issued stern calls of reform and action that were based on their philosophies and theologies, which had become very different since Julian's conversion to paganism. As Emperor Julian tried to stem the growing influence of Christianity and push for the revival of pagan Hellenism, and admonished his pagan priests to be of better character and more philanthropic, Gregory, on the other hand, desired to shape Hellenism in a more Christian direction, and often criticized the state of the episcopate and was also intent on promoting philanthropy. So I'm going to compare their perspectives on virtue and its relationship to philanthropy in their desire to shape the empire. Now, they both recognize the importance of philanthropy as a mechanism of influence in shaping Greek culture. They both emphasize closing the gap between theoria and praxis, or contemplation and action, that they saw in the philosophers and religious leaders of their day. And I suggest that this impulse is related to their desire to shape the culture of the empire in their respective directions. And since one's influence was highly dependent on the public recognition of one's virtue, finding ways to legitimize authority was extremely important. And thus they desired their leaders to be what I would call holistically authentic, to have more integrity and consistency, and to be more pious, pure, and philanthropic in order to have a stronger influence on Greek paideia. And paideia is a Greek word that means education or instruction, and it encapsulates everything about Greek learning and culture, and is concerned with the formation of the person. So since one's influence was highly dependent on the public recognition of one's virtue, now an unstated but underlying question for many in the 4th century, including Gregory and Julian, was this: how is authority legitimized? That is, throughout their work, they constantly appeal to various modes of validating authority, and not only for themselves, but also for the religious traditions they represented. And Claudia Rapp has written a book called Holy Bishops in Late Antiquity, and she outlines three major types of authority. That is, number one, spiritual authority, which is an indication that the bearer has received the Spirit of God. And this source of authority comes from outside the individual. It's not something earned, but it's a gift from God. And it's self-sufficient, and it's able to exist in the individual regardless of whether or not it is recognized by other people. The second type is ascetic authority, from ascesis, which means practice. And it's accessible to all by training, and its source is in the personal efforts of the bearer, who must practice discipline and pursue virtue toward an ideal of perfection. This type of authority is visible, depending on recognition by others, as it is manifested in one's conduct, appearance, and lifestyle. So one's ascetic authority is a confirmation of their spiritual authority. The third type is called pragmatic authority, from prato, to do. And it comes from one's actions toward the benefit of others, in distinction from asceticism, which is focused on shaping the self. So this type of authority was usually restricted to those who had the financial means and social position to carry it out, and it was always public. The recognition of this authority depended on the extent and success of the actions toward those who received it. So a helpful way to look at this is what I would call the five P's: piety, purity, philanthropy, paideia, and practicing what one preaches. So one could be pious and follow all the proper rituals and practice asceticism. However, unless one had purity of heart, it was useless, for having a pure heart is regularly emphasized as essential by many of the desert fathers and other ascetics. Philanthropy was an outward and concrete demonstration of one's authority, and popularity among the poor contributed to the rise and prominence of the bishop's authority. If any of you know about John Chrysostom, he was exiled from Constantinople by the political elites, but because he was so popular among the poor, they rioted and they had to bring him back. Paideia was a demonstration of one's authority and separated the highest levels of the intelligentsia from everyone else, and was very much connected to power. While paideia was often a sign of authority, it was not necessarily required, as several monks appealed to not having paideia at all. Practicing what one preaches is a timeless principle that was just as essential for consolidating authority then as it is now. We often criticize our politicians for not doing what they say. So, in a variety of ways, Gregory and Julian addressed all these issues throughout their writings in their aim to legitimize the authority of their respective religions. So in order to appreciate the dynamics of Gregory and Julian's efforts, it's helpful to understand the context and structures of gift economics and patronage, and how pagans and Christians traditionally approached philanthropy, and the ways in which authority was earned and legitimized in their day. So in terms of economics and patronage, many people in the ancient world lived quite literally hand to mouth in what's essentially a gift economy, where social stability was kept in place by reciprocal obligations between friends and between benefactors and recipients. So patronage linked many intangible networks of interactive debts and acted as a social and economic buffer in an economy where the voluntary relations of benefaction and giving occupied the place that the market and regulations fill in modern society. So such acts of patronage were known as a liturgia, which is usually translated as liturgies. So a liturgia was any public service performed by private citizens at their own expense. These liturgia, such as buildings and feasts, provided visible and tactile benefits and securities. And as such, they contributed to the public infrastructure and events, and they were investments in the overall well-being of the city. Aristotle makes an important distinction between liturgia and friendship, defining the equal exchange as between friends, and the unequal exchange as a liturgia, or a public service. So such liturgies were public. They always involved sacrifice, which affirmed their religious and pious significance, and they were the often daunting obligation of the upper class toward the fellow citizens. However, these liturgies did not include any concept of service to the poor until the rise of Christianity, which I'll talk about a little later. Now, while being recognized among one's peers for public generosity was something to be desired, it was not always for altruistic reasons. So sometimes landowners would strategically put their stored grain on the market during a famine to make a profit and to gain fame by saving their city. This type of economic system is what Peter Brown calls a civic model of society, which is vitally dependent on the rich, who gave for the good and betterment of the city and its people. A benefactor would often be praised as a Philopatris, a lover of his home city, but never as a Philoptokos, a lover of the poor. An important distinction needs to be made concerning the conception of the poor in the ancient world. As Susan Holman notes, there's a key difference between the two common words for the poor in the four centuries after Christ. Penes, which referred to the working poor, and tokoi, which described the destitute beggar or the street person. The former were recipients of the liturgia because they possessed some form of social status, for while they had very limited resources, they still functioned in society and were seen as contributors to civic life. The latter, the tokoi, up until the 4th century, were typically left out. The tokoi were not considered to be a legitimate social group, and thus were not deemed worthy recipients of benevolence or liturgia, since the principal aim of such acts of philanthropy were based on the equilibrium of civic life and the greater good of the community, not for the sake of the poor because they were poor. But to be fair, in comparison to other civilizations, the Greeks had actually a pretty good record of looking after the needy, and the philosophical ideal of philanthropy was surely present. However, there was still the ideal that when giving alms, that the recipients needed to be deemed worthy. As Plato put it, quote, "It is not the starving as such, or the similarly afflicted who deserve sympathy, but the man who, in spirit of his moderation, or some other virtue or progress toward it, nevertheless experiences some misfortune," unquote. And similar ideals can be found in Seneca and Cicero. The rise of Christianity and Christian charity played a role in shaping the Roman Empire and changing the ways in which the poor were looked after, for public giving was becoming less dramatized as a wealthy person's contribution to the vitality of the city and its citizens, and more of a gesture that reached out to the marginalized. While some historians pointed to the growth of the church as a symptom of this shift, other historians, most notably Peter Brown, points to the church and its bishops as the agents of change. Over time, the bishops who were rising in power and prominence, they made the poor more visible by finding them a place for them and for all the outsiders of all the classes within the civic community and within the civic conscience and identity, and by incorporating those from the social void into the liturgia of the church. Peter Brown says, "While philanthropy in the Greco-Roman world was often practiced as a social obligation of the individual citizen, intended to serve and improve the community, philanthropy as an expression of love and empathy from person to person was never absent. However, it was in Christianity that the poor man or woman was discovered as a person equal to the wealthy and the prominent," unquote. From the beginning, Christianity was socially revolutionary, breaking down the traditional barriers of racial and sexual distinction. Often pagan trade societies would split up the sexes and exclude slaves, but the Christians had them all together within a widespread Catholic movement. While worldwide groups of pagan sects were a rarity, so often the pagan cults were often localized to a city, whereas Christianity was more of a widespread movement. And one of Julian's strategies was to decentralize the empire so that he could strengthen the cities and therefore strengthen the pagan cults. Now, of course, often such ideals in the Christian church were never consistently practiced, and even though they were socially diverse, praising equality and disparaging the competition for honor, it often led to a moral hierarchism, competing in virtue. However, the ideals were always held in high esteem, and the New Testament is full of such admonitions, as well as many other Christian writings, such as the Apostolic Fathers. So the authority of and prominence of the bishop was on the rise, partly due to his relationship with the poor. So very early on, the bishop was responsible for looking after the poor, and the office took on new dimensions, though not necessarily a new role, especially in the 4th century. So while bishops and clergy were supported by the offerings of the faithful, they were also entrusted to redistribute it toward the poor. Thus, the bishop acted as a steward of the church's wealth. So this was a society within a society, forming a tight-knit community centered on the bishop. So by the time Constantine comes on the scene, in the early 4th century, the church was already a highly organized institution addressing the needs of the empire, with an ideology that linked the wealth of the church to the care of the poor. Now, a small but significant shift in emphasis changed Christian charity, which had typically cared for its own poor, and it was now being regarded as a public service, which was given in return for the public privileges they now received from the state. Essentially, Constantine defined the church as an institution to care for the poor, and this identity helped define the church's role in Roman society. Many Christians, including the Cappadocians and other bishops, were incorporating the lowest social groups into the liturgy of the church and showing benevolence to the poor because they were poor. The homeless and the destitute were excluded from the city's self-image, and in the opinion of Libanius, who was a teacher of rhetoric and a mentor of Julian, outcasts could not be considered of members of the citizen body. The Christian bishop, however, erected his authority over this social void, the tokoi, and the poor were defined as those who belonged to no social grouping. In late antiquity was a transition from a model of society where the poor were invisible to one where they played an increasingly imaginative role. Now, in terms of religious leadership, obviously, a leader's influence was highly dependent on the public recognition of his virtue. And while paideia and rhetoric and the art of persuasion were highly effective tools, they needed to be combined with act and practice, namely in personal ascesis and outward pragmatic deals toward others. Again, holistic authenticity. So those who had the most respect and influence were the ones who were able to combine various aspects of authority. They were powerful and persuasive in speech. They possessed spiritual authority from God. They were gifted in intercessory prayer and in miracles. Disciplined in asceticism, which is not only a sign of one's self-control over the passions, but also a sign of divine assistance. And they were also benevolent in their acts of kindness and philanthropy toward the community. In other words, they were holistic in the sense that all areas of life were immersed in virtue, both public and private. And they were authentic in the sense that their character was consistent and united in a spirit and practice of integrity, such as the ideal, namely for Julian and for Gregory. Now, early in his reign, Julian's legal reforms were aimed at removing the church's position of privilege while giving it to the pagan cults. However, as time went on, his subtler restrictions toward the Christians got more intense. One of his more famous pieces of legislation was the Education Edict, which banned Christian teachers from teaching in the schools. Julian wanted to solve the problem at its source, and if he could influence the younger generation of the thinking minds by taking control of Greek learning and paideia, slowly but surely he would turn the tide of the empire within a few decades. To combat the growing Christian influence, he decided to fight fire with fire and incorporated Christian models of success into his own new version of paganism. To do this, he needed his pagan priests to command the same type of reverence and authority in the public sphere that the Christian bishops did. However, authority was something to be earned and not won overnight, and a consistent moralizing theme throughout Julian's writings entailed that there were no shortcuts to the legitimate spiritual life, for what was preached needed to be practiced. So these tendencies in Julian's are present in his desire to shape the pagan philosophers in his day, who, like the teachers, were a formative influence on Greek culture and paideia. In Julian's Oration Against the Cynic Philosophers, to the Uneducated Cynics, Oration 6, and Against Heraclius, Oration 7, he sets out to expound his ideal of how to live the philosophic life, holding up the famous Diogenes, the archetype of cynicism, as a model. And I should note that the ancient concept of the philosopher was a lot different than today. Philosophy back then was much more a way of life, a culture cultivating virtue and forming the person, and it wasn't as cerebral, I guess, as maybe a lot of modern philosophy is. And philosophy was always set within a community. So you had the cynics, you had the stoics, you had various groups of people meeting together. It's almost, philosophy seemed to be more like a religion back then than it is today. Julian's treatises against the cynic philosophers criticized their outward pious appearance that was not supported by their internal character. In other words, they were not practicing the ideals they preached. He accuses the contemporary cynics of not being good disciples of Diogenes, for they had not tamed the wild beast of their passions and have become depraved. They were eager for the reputation associated with being a cynic, without the ascetic harshness, which they saw as being hazardous to the body, which is most precious. They viewed the habits of the cynics of old, such as Diogenes and Crates, as being miserable and foolish. And Julian's desire to combine theoria and praxis is also seen in this treatise. Quote, therefore, we must return to the elements of the philosophy of the cynics. Now, indeed, it seems that they customarily follow the divisions of philosophy, the contemplative and the practical, just as Aristotle and Plato did, evidently because they had observed and understood that humanity is by nature was made fit for both action and the pursuit of knowledge. Unquote. The hypocrisy of these pretenders was a great annoyance to Julian, for it was bringing all philosophers into disrepute and tarnishing their reputations. Now, these tendencies also carried over to Julian's writings towards his own pagan priests. The fragment of his letter to a priest demonstrates the connection in his thought between the high moral ideas, integrity, and philanthropic action that he wanted to see in his priests, and the effect it would have in inducing people to follow the gods instead of being seduced by Christianity. The moral character and action of the priests would give them a public face to inspire pious action toward the gods. Julian gives a lengthy discussion on philanthropy and the priesthood, and explained that philanthropy brings many blessings, most importantly, the blessings of the gods. The priest must be the prime example of holiness in order to guide others, and above all else, practice philanthropy. Quote, inasmuch as the life of the priest ought to be more holy than the political life, you must guide and instruct men to adopt it. You must above all else exercise philanthropy. For from it result many other blessings, and moreover, the choicest blessing of all, the goodwill of the gods. God, who naturally loves human beings, has more kindness for those men who love their fellows. Unquote. Julian advocates that money should be shared with everyone, though one should be more generous to those who are good. In this, he is consistent with a typical Greco-Roman concept of assessing the worthiness of the recipients of largesse. However, he makes a significant departure from this trend by putting value on giving to the unworthy. Quote, we ought then to share our money with all men, but more generously with the good, and with the helpless and poor so as to suffice for their need. And I will assert, even though it would be paradoxical to say so, that it would be a pious act to share our clothes and food even with the wicked. For it is to the humanity in a man that we give, and not to his moral character. Hence I think that even those who are shut up in prison have a right to the same sort of care, since this kind of philanthropy will not hinder justice. Unquote. So what's significant here is that Julian is both acknowledging the customary practice of moral assessment of worthiness and also subverting it. Even if giving to the wicked is paradoxical, he says, he chooses to assert this as an act of piety, which is a significant shift in traditional approaches to philanthropy, and one of the ways that Julian set new precedents in his conception of philanthropy and religion. Julian's rationale for philanthropy comes mainly from his injunction to imitate the gods and also his appeal to a general reverence for humanity and human solidarity, ideas which can also be found in Stoicism and Cynicism. Julian also points to divine reason for benevolence and solidarity and asks that if Zeus, who's called the god of strangers, how can one approach his temple and offer a sacrifice in good conscience? Such a one has forgotten the saying taken from the Odyssey, quote, from Zeus come all beggars and strangers, and a gift is precious though small, unquote. Julian gives another appeal to follow the example of Zeus and worship him with integrity of practice, upholding the intrinsic value of being human and a reminder of kinship and solidarity. Quote, again, the man who worships Zeus, the god of comrades, and who, though he sees his neighbors in need of money, does not even give them so much as a drachma, can he think that he is worshiping Zeus aright? The gods are called by us gods of kindred, and Zeus the god of strangers, but we treat our kinsmen as though they were strangers. I say kinsmen, because every man, whether he will or no, is akin to every other man. Unquote. Gregory, too, will also argue for imitating the divine example and for the intrinsic value of the human, but his rationale for the value comes from being made in the image of God and the implications of the incarnation of Christ. Now, in terms of what is required for being a priest, being rich or poor, famous or unknown, was irrelevant in the selection of a priest. If he possesses within himself these two things, love for God and love for his fellow men, philanthropon, let him be appointed a priest, Julian would say. Inspiring love for the gods and others, sharing cheerfully with the needy, and trying to do good to as many as he is able demonstrates proof of this love. Throughout this treatise, especially in his requirements of the priests, the key issue for Julian is for priests to prove with outward action the inward quality of their piety and purity. The priest must prove his love for the gods and his authority to be a priest by his actions, and must establish his pragmatic authority in addition to his ascetic and spiritual authority. Julian is quite clear as to why outward benevolence was so important. Quote, "We must pay special attention to this point, and by this means effect a cure. For when it came about that the poor were neglected and overlooked by the priests, then I think that the impious Galileans observed this fact and devoted themselves to philanthropy." He refers to Christians as Galileans. "And they have gained ascendancy in the worst of their deeds to the credit they win for such practices." Unquote. The effect of the Christians' actions and reputation for taking care of the poor greatly aggravated the pagan emperor and prompted him to enact an aggressive public relations campaign among his priests to cast them in a more favorable light. Image and reputation, it seems, were crucial in Julian's counter-strategy. And here's a quote from another letter. "The Hellenic religion does not yet prosper as I desire, and it is the fault of those who profess it. For the worship of the gods is on a splendid and magnificent scale, surpassing every prayer and every hope. While we do not observe that it is the Christians' benevolence to strangers, their care for the graves of the dead, and the pretended holiness of their lives that have done the most to increase atheism." A lot of ancient Christians were referred to as atheists because they only worshipped one god. Julian again says, "I believe that we ought really and truly to practice every one of these virtues." Julian also says, "Admonish them that no priest may enter a theater or drink in a tavern or control any craft or trade that is base and not respectable. In every city establish frequent hostels in order that strangers may profit by our benevolence. I do not mean for our own people only, but for others also who are in need of mercy. I have given direction that 30,000 modi of corn shall be assigned every year for the whole of Galatia and 60,000 pints of wine. I order that one-fifth of this be used for the poor who serve the priests, and the remainder to be distributed by us to strangers and beggars. For it is disgraceful that, when no Jew ever has to beg, and the impious Galileans support not only their own poor but ours as well, all men see that our people lack aid from us. Teach those of the Hellenic faith to contribute to public service, or liturgia, of this sort, and the Hellenic villages to offer the first fruits to the gods, and accustom those who love the Hellenic religion to these good works by teaching them that this was our practice of old. Then let us not, by allowing others to outdo us in good works, disgrace by such remissness, or rather utterly abandon the reverence due to the gods." Unquote. Now much can be said about this passage, but it essentially provides a glimpse into Julian's pious motivations, frustrations, and practical actions. While Julian recognizes the political implications of the situation and sees it as a great competition, the later comments also show that he is concerned for reverencing the gods. This was not merely a political issue for Julian, but intimately tied with his personal religious beliefs. Now, there's an article recently about this latest letter calling the question of how authentic it was or whether it was an exaggeration. And I will acknowledge this past letter might be a bit... Sometimes ancient Christians might have tampered with letters of other people in the past, but this particular letter is consistent with a lot of other things Julian said and with some of his reforming practices. So for my purposes, trying to show that Julian is sort of getting angry with Christian philanthropy is quite consistent with everything else he did and said. Now, Julian's attempt at moralizing his citizens were not very successful, as his satire against the people of Antioch, Mesopagon, reveals. Julian was shocked and dismayed by their impiety and lack of observance of sacrifice. As Julian himself recognized, his piety, austere morals, love of justice made him unpopular in Antioch. In fact, they nicknamed him the butcher because he performed so many animal sacrifices. In terms of his motivations and justification for the way he was, Julian points to his tutor and to the great philosophers, namely Plato, for forming his way of life. Quote, "And another of Plato's laws has made me take thought for myself and so become hateful in your eyes. I mean the law which says that those who govern, and also the older men, ought to train themselves in respect for others and in self-control, in order that the masses may look to them and so order their own lives aright. Now since I alone, or rather in company with a few others, am now pursuing this course, it has had a very different result and has naturally become a reproach against me. Had Julian lived longer, things may have been different, but such speculation belongs to the novelist and not the historian." Now, regarding Gregory of Nazianzen, as one might expect, he was responding to the crucial issues of his time. for his life and writings were formidably shaped by his context and reflect a lifelong striving for a Christian shaping of Hellenism. The threat of Julian's legacy had a lasting effect on Gregory, for the whole of his corpus was intended as a theological manual for Christian intellectuals and Episcopal leader, shaped in response to Julian's challenge, and also over the ownership of Greek culture and Paideia. So Gregory recognized the importance of combining contemplation and action, theoria and praxis, in his writings concerning the religious leadership and his promotion to philanthropy. Not only did he criticize the failings of many bishops, but along with the other Cappadocians, he advocated a model of what the ideal bishop should be, the middle way of the monk-bishop, who combined contemplation and practice, modeled after the life of Moses, who himself received a good education early in life, withdrew into the desert, and returned to lead the people. This ideal synthesized the holy man and the civic ecclesiastical leader and integrated the spiritual, ascetic, and pragmatic types of authority into a single person. Such people were able to legitimize their authority because they were pious, pure, and philanthropic. Not only did Gregory advocate piety and purity of character for those in religious leadership, he also promoted the combination of contemplation and action, solitude and communal living, and concrete outworking of his theological ideals in the practice of philanthropy by including the poor and outcasts under the umbrella of Christian identity. Now, when Julian became emperor, that was about the same time that Gregory was ordained to the priesthood. But despite the emperor's premature death, the shadow that Julian cast at the beginning of Gregory's ecclesiastical career always seemed to haunt him and many other Christians. Julian's time on the throne and his education edict prompted Gregory to write two scathing invectives against him, Orations 4 and 5, and at times it seems that Gregory had forgotten Jesus' command to love one's enemies because his tone is so harsh. Gregory saw Julian as a real threat in the struggle over culture and Paideia, and was trying to encourage others that Christianity would overcome its enemies with love and patience, for the philanthropy and ethic of the Christians is what distinguished them from the pagans. However, Gregory's invectives also reveal valuable insight into the nature of the struggle over Paideia, and demonstrate Julian and Gregory's common love for it, and show the degree to which they both saw and shows the degree to which Gregory saw Julian as a threat, which supports the notion that the legacy of Julian was a catalyst for the aggressive Cappadocian promotion of philanthropy in the years after the emperor's death. So determined not to let Julian or someone like him outdo Christianity's welfare institutions, Gregory and the other Cappadocians' fathers would be involved in promoting such projects and the virtues of philanthropy, which I'll discuss in a couple minutes. So Gregory, like Julian, emphasized the importance of having men of character in leadership roles, for Gregory was often dissatisfied with the state of the church leadership, and he also lamented many people he saw as not being qualified to lead. Not only was such integrity influential, but theoria and practice were essential for doing true philosophy, theology, and for properly approaching God. Such ideals can be seen in Gregory's views toward asceticism and philanthropy, which were vital ingredients for his ideal of the true philosopher. Philosophy could not be mere speculations about doctrine or systematic analysis about reality. It must also involve a refined and disciplined practice of self-mastery. Contemplation and action are essential parts of his ideal of the true philosophy, which he reveals in his first oration against Julian. Quote, "All philosophy is divided into two aspects, contemplation and practice. The one is loftier, but hard to approach through the warrants of experience. The other is humbler, but more useful. In our view, each is seen as valuable because of the other. For we make contemplation our companion on the way to the next life, and practice our means of access to contemplation. After all, it is impossible to share in wisdom without behaving wisely." Just as Julian was upset with his pagan priests, Gregory was upset with the state of the episcopacy and was the most outspoken and critical of all the fathers on the subject. The three Cappadocians also saw the state of the episcopate as being in crisis. Not only were they concerned about the adherence to Nicene doctrine, but they also recognized the poverty of ascetic practice among the religious leadership. Both Gregory Nazianzen and Gregory of Nyssa spent a lot of time and ink on their view of what the ideal bishop should embody. That is, one who was familiar with both the desert and the city, and who could travel the middle way of being a monk bishop. Their ideas were quite successful, for they had a massive impact on the episcopate and monasticism in their time and in later centuries. Basil of Caesarea was praised by both Gregory's as an example of what a religious leader should be, fusing both the active and contemplative lives. The episcopate was in desperate need of more leaders who were both experienced aesthetically and theologically orthodox. Not only that, such leaders would have to be willing to sacrifice their contemplative solitude in order to serve and address the pressing needs of the church. The Cappadocian bishops were involved with the promotion and construction of a massive and multifaceted welfare institution, later known as the Basileus, just outside of the city of Caesarea. This institution, which was somewhat of a novelty in its day, provided hospital services, residences for the poor, travelers, the bishop and clergy, and included small factories and workshops for teaching and practicing trades. The Basileus was rather successful, for it attracted poor immigrants from distant regions and served as a model for later institutions. Despite its construction outside Caesarea, it grew so large and endured that it became the new Caesarea, while the original Greco-Roman city declined and crumbled. And I'll say more about this at the end, in connection with what I do at the Mustard Seed. The effects of Julian's reign, despite its brevity to his premature death, were not forgotten several years later, when the Cappadocians were promoting projects such as the Basileus. Gregory's Oration number 14 on the love of the poor, which inherently was a fundraiser for the institution, was an historically important treatise that set the terms for the imperial Christian policy of philanthropy. Saturated in scriptural references from top to bottom, this oration draws heavily from the rich poverty and justice themes from both biblical testaments. However, throughout the oration, the cardinal example is that of Christ himself and his humility, and the significance of the Incarnation. Gregory lists many of the great virtues, such as hospitality, patience, gentleness, fasting, chastity, virginity, solitude and silence, and calls to memory the great biblical figures that exemplified these. He sums up all these virtues into theoria and praxis, and explains their complementary nature. Quote, "To put it still more concisely concerning all these virtues, contemplation is a good thing, and action is also a good thing. The first, when it raises us up and leads us to the Holy of Holies, guiding our mind upward toward what is akin to it. The second, when it receives Christ as its guest and looks after him, revealing the spell of love by its works." Unquote. Now, after listing all these great virtues, Gregory points to the greatest of them all. Quote, "Following Christ and Paul, the greatest is love. And if following the command of Paul and Christ himself, we must suppose that love is the first and greatest of the commandments, the crowning point of the law and prophets. I must conclude that love of the poor and compassion and sympathy for our own flesh and blood is its most excellent form. For God is not so served by any of the virtues as he is by mercy." Like Julian, Gregory also appeals to human solidarity and kinship as a reason for benevolence, which is one of the most significant themes in his oration. Gregory stresses the solidarity of the entire human family, the rich and the poor, those with diseases or leprosy, the orphans and widows are all one in their humanity, for all share in the same nature and image of God. Therefore, all must help the needy. And in this sermon, Gregory brings up a powerful image, contrasting the beautiful chanting inside the church and the wailing and crying of the lepers outside. God creates the resources of the world to be shared by all, and the inequalities of society, Gregory says, such as poverty and riches, freedom and slavery, are all human inventions resulting from sin and not from God. Quote, "Freedom and riches consisted simply in observing the commandments, while true poverty and slavery came from their transgression." Unquote. Gregory not only appeals to human solidarity, but also a divine human solidarity because of his theology of the Incarnation. Christ is the ultimate example, who humbled himself so far as to share in the mixture of our nature. He exhorts his audience, who has received such a great example, not to ignore or overlook the needy or treat them as detestable. In an echo of Matthew chapter 25, Gregory identifies Christ with the poor and urges others to take care of him. Quote, "Let us take care of Christ while there is still time. Let us minister to Christ's needs. Let us give Christ nourishment. Let us clothe Christ. Let us gather Christ in. Let us show Christ honor. But since the Lord of all things desires mercy and not sacrifice, and since a compassionate heart is worth more than tens of thousands of fat rams, let us give this gift to him through the needy, who today are cast down on the ground, so that when we are all released from this place, they may receive us into the eternal tabernacle in Christ himself, who is our Lord, to whom be glory for all ages. Amen." Unquote. While Julian and Gregory both use similar foundational argument about human kinship, there are significant differences. The source of Gregory's solidarity comes from humanity's status as being made in the image of God, as well as the significance of God being human in the incarnation. Now, Donald Winslow indicates that Gregory's assertion of the divine human solidarity is the place where he simultaneously stands the closest to and the furthest from his Greek philosophical heritage. Common in Hellenism was the idea of men being thought of as gods, most notably in their acts of mercy and kindness, which caused humans to resemble them. Such ideas can be found in Marcus Aurelius, Longinus, Pliny, and Philo, among others. Despite the similarities between them, Winslow points out the significant differences. Quote, Gregory's statement that we resemble God in acts of compassion is related not to any presuppositions concerning the divine attributes and our ability to emulate them, but to the specific act of compassion wrought by God in Jesus Christ. Gregory calls his hearers to have within them God's own compassionating love in respect to those who suffer and are poor. Yet precisely because it was God in Jesus Christ that suffered and became poor for us, in our ministry to the needy, we also minister to Christ. By being like him, we become like him, for it is he that has become like us. Such a concept of imitatio is a far cry from its pagan counterpart. We are one with the poor, and we are one with Christ. Gregory's understanding of these two concepts has obvious and immediate implications, determining the difference between Christian and non-Christian attitudes towards love for the poor. Now, John McGuckin observes that philanthropy in the Christian sense was based on the image of the poor man Jesus, who taught of the blessedness of the poor and the simple lifestyle. True humanity is manifested in charitable acts of compassion and is discovered by the Christian philosopher by transcending the limits of human frailty and weakness, not by accepting them. Human meaning is given its starting point in love, and the aim is toward mystical communion with God. The one who shows compassion receives grace, and they are mirrors of God, who is the great philanthropist. McGuckin comments further on the uniqueness of Gregory's perspective. Quote, what Gregory offers, therefore, is more than a new social policy. It is a fundamentally renewed anthropology based on the Christian doctrine of the Incarnation, when image and archetype were reconciled in the homogenization of God as a poor man. Unquote. So here in Christianity, you have a poor man at the center of a religion, and the roots of this religion is poverty and a homeless man, and that filters out into the fabric of the rest of the religion. Now, both Julian and Gregory were in a predicament. How are they to shape the empire they lived in? Given the nature and context of the 4th century, it's quite interesting how their actions reflected much of what was going on around them. After 3 centuries of growth and the patronage of Constantine and his son, Christianity was on the rise, and Julian's beloved pagan Hellenism was by no means dead, but in decline in the 4th century. After the triumph of Constantine, and the church had the imperial treasury at their bestowal, and many other perks, only to be reversed by Julian's attempt to revive traditional religion and remove the Christian intelligentsia from having any influence on Paideia. Such a reversal of fortunes naturally caused great concern and anxiety in the church, and led to growing fears of being subdued by another Decius or Diocletian, Gregory being a prime example of this. So the struggle over Greek culture was the battleground for Gregory and Julian. How did they respond? What strategies did they employ to shape the culture of the empire? In some ways, they used similar ones. They certainly used their skills in rhetoric and paideia that they had learned while studying together in Athens. And in their own way, they acted as patrons. Julian became the new patron of pagan Hellenism, bestowing money, legal reforms and benefits, and gifts of treatises on behalf of the cults. Gregory and the Cappadocians became patrons of the poor, given the gifts of their sermons and by incorporating them into the liturgical imagery of the church. Recognizing the importance of legitimizing authority and establishing credibility, emphasizing theoria and praxis was essential. Authority had to be genuine to be legitimate, and if either of Julian or Gregory's respective movements were going to make any progress, they needed integrity and consistency, not just internally, but visibly. So there wasn't any room for hypocrisy in either of their minds. Consequently, Julian was frustrated with Cynic impostors who were damaging the reputation not only of the great Diogenes and cynicism in general, but all philosophers. And Julian also admonished his priests to be pious and pure, proving it not only by rituals and chaste behavior, but also with visible acts of philanthropy. The Christians were outdoing them in this area, which aggravated Julian and urged him to make things difficult while trying not to make martyrs out of the Christians. Likewise, Gregory railed against the hypocrisy and lack of integrity of the Christian leadership, who were spiritually unfit and unprepared for their position, and who were the source of much internal strife that the church was struggling from. The church needed leaders who had credibility and influence, and the monk bishop was a perfect solution, especially as a spokesman for the poor. While the Cappadocian promotion of philanthropy may not have been initiated by Julian's reign, it was likely intensified by it. Taking hold of the deep roots of the Judeo-Christian tradition, and by incorporating the poor into the liturgy of the church, philanthropy is one of the concrete ways in which Gregory and the Cappadocians strove to legitimize the authority and strengthen the influence of the church on Greek culture. Concerns about the poor by Julian and Gregory were not just motivated by a competition over Hellenism, and one cannot conclude that either of them were not moved out of a genuine concern for the need. Julian had many ideals to draw from the philanthropic concerns of Greek literature and practice, and Gregory had much to draw from the Judeo-Christian tradition. Yet it seems that the church had been better organized in its practice of philanthropy, especially after the patronage of Constantine, which Julian was struggling to compete with, and his efforts were perhaps too little too late, especially since he died so early in his reign. Nevertheless, throughout this struggle, they both recognized the importance of legitimizing the authority of their respective religious traditions, not just with words but also with actions, emphasizing holistic authenticity and piety, purity, and philanthropy. Now, in terms of what I do at the Mustard Seed, while comparing the Basileus, which I guess was maybe an ancient mustard seed in the 4th century, it's kind of difficult to compare the two because of geography and time, but I would like to draw a few parallels. First of all, the Basileus was a multifaceted institution, and it aimed to serve a wide variety of people with different needs who are often on the margins of society. And so, too, the guests that we serve at the Mustard Seed come from a variety of backgrounds and have all sorts of different kinds of barriers, and they've all fallen through various cracks in the system that we create in society. So we deal with far more than just poverty, because chances are, if you give poor people a legitimate opportunity, often they'll do well with it. And a good example of that is microfinance, say in English and in India and Bangladesh. You give poor people an opportunity, you give them access to the economy, and often they're resourceful enough and they'll find a way to support themselves. But most of our people are not successful with many of the opportunities that are given to them because they're inhibited by mental illness, addictions, brain injuries, social deficits, a variety of reasons. So at the Seed, we try to be multifaceted in our approach. And we try to offer a variety of programs and services that meet people at whatever stage of transition they're at. We have several stages of transitional housing where they go from sleeping on a mat in a warehouse to shared accommodations to independent living, and they progress through different levels of independence and responsibility. We have an arts and recreation program where they can learn to express themselves in music and art and also have a cathartic release of outdoor sports and activities. And we also have a health and wellness clinic for medical appointments, a team of caseworkers to help them to take steps to get off the street, and we have education and employment programs to help them with resumes, job search, and computer skills. And we also employ some of our guests to do facility and janitorial maintenance, and we're developing trades training programs to help them get careers and not just short-term jobs. So we want to help them gain confidence and take pride and ownership with the duty that they are responsible for. The Basileus was also holistic in its approach, and we try to do the same. Not only did it offer a variety of physical and practical services, it also took the soul and spirit seriously, and it was centered on chapel and administered by a clergy. And as a Christian organization, the Mustard Seed also aims to be holistic, not just in providing our various programs, but also because we understand that faith and spiritual practice are an important part of a healthy life. We understand that those we serve may not share our views, and we have a policy of not forcing them on people, but we don't want to hide the value and strength that we draw from our faith. Our case management system is centered on a series of questions that deals with various aspects of a person's life that need to be balanced in order to achieve health and independence, not just financial or housing concerns, but also social, spiritual, and physical health of the individual. So if someone's doing well financially, maybe they have a house, but if they don't have many friends, then we'll try to encourage them to spend time in a recreation apartment and sort of develop those social ties. The Basileus was also a community in itself, dependent on the church community and the community at large, and Gregory Nazianzen called it a new city, where the poor and lepers were looked after and cared for. So too, the Seed is a community which is heavily dependent and involved with the local church and the civic community of Calgary, as they support us financially and with the help of a multitude of volunteers. So the sense of safety and community and being cared for is what many of our guests appreciate most about the Seed, and we find it's essential for progress and transformation of their lives. The old African proverb, "It takes a village to raise a child," couldn't be truer. And I think, you know, if you think of any of our lives, where would we be without the communities that we had that support us? And I find that the people we work with, the ones that are the most successful, are the ones that we have developed the strongest relationship with and that come back regularly, and we have a sense, we've developed a sense of trust so that we can speak into their lives. And often a lot of the people we work with can be socially inappropriate or have improper boundaries or hygiene concerns, and that can often hinder their chances of finding employment or keeping employment. So in many ways, we sometimes have to model different types of behavior implicitly and explicitly, but obviously we have to develop that sense of trust and relationship, and they have to know that we care about them genuinely. But this only comes with time and with patience, and because transformation can really take a lifetime, and just think about things about yourself that you'd like to change that can take years or months or your whole life. And we recognize that it's about relationship and about community and not just about programs and services. But essentially, I think it boils down to love and practicing what we preach, which means being authentic with them in every area and holistically authentic, not just with their head, but with their heart and their hands, and not only with their wallets. So, thank you for your time.
Maybe I can kick this off a little bit with a couple of things that I wonder about, given what you have to say. For Julian's approach and Gregory's approach to the poor, in the end, is there any difference for the poor?
For the poor.
Or is the difference simply for those who are caring for the poor?
That's an interesting question. I think if any of you are familiar with Rodney Stark's book, The Rise of Christianity, came out in 97, he talks a lot about the rapid growth of the Christian movement in the first 3 to 4 centuries. And I think they had a growth rate of about 40%, which is unheard of for a lot of movements. And he attributes it to a strong social network in the Christian communities. And there were two major famines in the 2nd and 3rd century that decimated millions of people in the Roman Empire. And Stark attributes it to Christians had a higher survival rate in the cities, because when the plagues would come in, a lot of the rich pagans in the city would just leave. But because Christians had strong social networks, they took care of each other, had a higher survival rate, and then basically there were a higher proportion of them in the cities. And I think maybe just the growth of Christianity maybe is a testament to the fact that they did a good job of taking care of each other. In Julian's day, I'm not sure. I mean, I think he definitely cared about the poor, I think in a genuine sense. And whether how well the pagan priests took care of the poor in the temples, I'm not sure. But obviously, like in that one letter, he doles out tons and tons of wine and grain to take care of them. So I think in some sense they were taken care of. And as Constantilos says, that compared to other cultures, the Greco-Romans did a decent job of taking care of the poor. But still, there was this social void of the destitute that were kind of off the radar.
But is the difference that the Christian communities, obviously not dependent on the state, is there a thicker sense of community life and caring on that kind of level versus the state? I mean, if we just look at the whole experiment with liberal democratic societies and the welfare state, I mean, one of the startling things about it, probably more compellingly written about by Michael Ignatieff than anybody else I know, in his book 15 years ago or so on the poor, that the state institutionalization of services to the poor creates a bureaucracy as opposed to bringing people into a community.
Mm-hmm.
Is there something of that going on?
I think so. I think Gregory's point about the incarnation and Matthew chapter 25 was a huge verse for the early, huge chapter for the early church, where, because it's Christ talking about when I was naked and you clothed me, I was in prison and you visited me. Because you have, at the center of Christianity, you have a poor man. I mean, Mother Teresa had a quote saying, "Why do you worship a homeless man on Sunday and ignore him on Monday?" So right at the center of Christianity, you have a poor homeless man, which is different when, say, in paganism, you have basically a collection of a lot of cults, mostly based in a particular city, a lot based on, say, fertility, and then you have a lot of the Greek gods that are fighting with each other. So I think in every thread of Christianity, at the base you have this ethic of poverty and this sort of unity with, you know, every person, every poor person identified with Christ. And I think...
And a direct way to respond...
Yeah.
You have to respond directly.
Yeah.
I mean, I think of Chrysostom's extraordinary railing against the emperor when the emperor passed an edict making all the homeless people in Constantinople banishing them, saying you have to leave the city, and then turning around with his left hand and granting bishops a license to open hostels. And then Chrysostom, this is really, I think this is the origin of the welfare system myself, then Chrysostom, in his Sunday sermon, you know this better than I, comes on like gangbusters and says, in judgment of the bishops, because if you open hostels, you destroy the Christian family. Because the Christian family can only exist, Chrysostom argues, if you have a bedroll, a loaf of bread, and a candle for Jesus Christ, who you meet in the poor person on the way home, or who knocks at your door wanting something. I mean, his emphasis was the larger state structure is a terrible, creates a situation where you actually no longer do your proper duty as a Christian, which is always direct.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's more integral. It's kind of more of a bottom-up kind of ethic than one imposed from the top, like saying a bureaucracy. But even in some of my readings, I guess in a lot of pagan orations and rhetoric, there was often references to poor and poverty and such, but it was never the center of a major treatise until the Christian era. And like in Greek philosophy, you have the ideal of taking care of the poor and philanthropy, but as far in the actual pagan cultic practice, it wasn't there very much, and not to the extent it was in Christianity. So from the get-go, I mean, you already have a strong foundation of the Jewish prophets and the Old Testament, which have strong poverty and justice themes all throughout. And the prophets are always angry at the people for neglecting the poor. And then Christianity just kind of, you know, inherits that legacy and then has, you know, Christ as being this poor person and the whole poverty ethic there. So
I was wondering if the argument could be made, or it has been named, that Julian essentially was Christian in that emphasis on the poor, that seems to me kind of new. It's sort of alien to the pagan heritage that he's supposedly trying to restore.
Mm-hmm.
He just said a pagan baptized a Christian model.
Was there as much emphasis on relationship with, as opposed to the great Quaker? Was it how did they both view the relationship with the person, with the poor person? Was it, in Gregory, it seems to me that there was more emphasis put on relationship, but I'm not sure if I missed.
Well, that could be true. I mean, I think Julian, he was such a idealist in the sense that he really loved, I mean, both Gregory and Julian loved Greek philosophy. And he just really wanted everyone to be very moral and very ethical with it. And I think it was just part of his whole system that, you know, if you're going to honor the gods right, then you better take care of the poor. I don't recall so much, I'm not sure about the actual relationship with the actual person in Julian would say. I don't know.
Maybe the sources just don't yield that.
No, I mean, I think we kind of, in our day, we talk a lot about relationship directly, and maybe it was there, but they didn't express it in the same way. So,
can you talk a little bit about the, you mentioned a couple times that you're the wealth of the church, and I'm hearing this tension a little bit when we're talking about, you know, the one thing you're talking about, the founder of the religion being Jesus, homeless, poor. And you have, in this day and age, you have nations like Vanity, right? And this idea of giving away everything as the spiritual ideal of who you're meant to be, and this idea of the church as the poor, in some sense. And yet, on the other hand, you have this tension of this institution that's becoming wealthy. I mean, this is a period where, when my history isn't great here, but, I mean, you know, Constantine onwards, right? This is when the wealth, the property owning of this institution grows. So on the one hand, you have sort of this idea of patronage, of liturgia, of wealthy giving, but on the other hand, you have this idea of these institutions of the poor, for the poor. And these seem to me to be in tension with one another. And one of them can claim Jesus, in some sense, legitimately, and the other one, it's really almost the Roman ideal.
They claim Jesus in order to be
right, so it seems like there's a tension here. And I'm wondering how something like Gregory, right, who's now Archbishop, who's, you know, in a period of ascending political power for the institution, like, is this a tension that he feels? I don't really have a well-focused question, but it just seems to me that there's this incipient tension. I'm just wondering how it gets worked out, if it's thought about.
Well, I think it might be related to his personal tension between the contemplative life and then the ecclesiastical career he had. He always just wanted to stay in his own little town and just be a monk all by himself and read and write. But he kept getting kind of sucked into, like, he didn't really want to be ordained, but Basil kind of kidnapped him in that sense. He didn't really want to be a bishop. They were, yeah, like I said, they were frenemies. But, and he didn't really want to be a high political figure. And he wasn't a very successful, you know, political figure. And he kind of was forced to resign as Archbishop of Constantinople for a variety of reasons. But I think the monk-bishop model is kind of the ideal they espouse because, like John Chrysostom, you have someone who's coming from the desert and they're in the city, but they still have the desert in their heart. They still have that fasting and ascesis, and it's the balance. Otherwise, because, you know, after Constantine, instead of the bishop, the first one getting, you know, martyred, he was now in a prime position of political influence and leadership, right? So there's that tension, and I think with the wealth of the church, like, the first three centuries, the church was getting wealthier and wealthier, and the bishop was the one that would dole out all the poor. But there's one, I think a letter of Cyprian, where they had, like, over 1,000 people, 1,000 widows and orphans on their poor roll. So they would support a ton of people in the church. But with Gregory, like, he came from a pretty wealthy aristocratic family, and he never really got rid of that wealth. He still owned stuff. But he lived as an ascetic, and he lived as a monk, but I think with the church at large, that definitely was a huge tension. Even today, you have wealthy Christians in North America, and you have a ton of poor Christians in Africa and Asia. And I think I've heard it said that when Constantine came, it was both the Christianization of the empire and the paganization of the church, and I think both happened. And, I mean, there's been that tension, you know, since the Old Testament prophets. So,
I mean, my sense is that when Constantine called an end to the persecution, often we just don't appreciate what that must have meant, particularly for the upper echelon of the leadership. All of a sudden, they're no longer having to look over their shoulder and no longer having to figure out whether they're going to get themselves or people they know are going to be taken away. And then of course, he makes the church one of the two official religions. So all of a sudden, in the face coming out of the persecution, there's this huge opportunity. The question is, do they still see themselves as aesthetics and pastors, or do they suddenly become real estate? And this is a problem we now have in Russia, Serbia, Romania. It's a problem in the Muslim world. It's a current problem in Turkey, because the new government in Turkey is open to believe. So all of a sudden, Muslims over there, instead of being persecuted, which they were seriously under after, are suddenly in this new opportunity. What are they going to do with it? So this is it's understandable what happens, but it's unbelievably tragic that that's the turn that it takes.
Maybe it's outside of the boundaries of the theme here, and maybe it's an unanswerable question too, but what is the source of Julian's wish to restore the ancient traditions? You know, he comes from a Christian dynasty.
Well, though, the thing was that his uncle was Constantine, and Constantine's son, Constantius, when he came to power, killed off most of Julian's family. Like, killed off a lot of the other Constantines, and basically it was just Julian, his cousin, and maybe one or two other relatives that were left. So he might have had, you know, a bit of a hate on for Christians coming from that. But I think he was also fascinated by a lot of the pagan cults.
He saw Constantine doing that because...
Constantine's son.
Yeah, of his relationship to the Christian tradition.
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, but again, like seeing... Being in the wealthy court, seeing aristocratic Christianity might have turned him off. Or I think part of it was also just a fascination with sort of... He was really into, like, sacrifice, the theurgy, which is like a lot of incantation and reciting all these sort of kind of mystery cults and like really obscure rites, and just maybe that was just really enamoring to him too. And he just had a love for the Greek philosophers, as Gregory did, but he thought it was hypocritical, and this is why he banned Christians from teaching in the schools, is because he said, how can you teach the classic philosophers and not believe in the gods that they believe in? So he just thought it was inconsistent. Yeah. Yeah. But he was a fascinating character. I mean, he was only in power for less than 2 years, but he left quite a legacy in that sense. So, I mean, people aren't sure how he died in battle, because it was a campaign going into Persia, but some people think it was a Christian that did him in from behind, but there's conflicting sources about that, so... Actually, there's an icon over some saint that is attributed with killing Julian, and that's pretty interesting.
Yeah, by a heretical wing of the church.
Yeah.
So. Are we doing any better in philanthropy and magnificism in the churches? I mean, we don't seem to me we're actually, because the state does a lot of stuff, people in the congregations don't. We have to do it anymore. So it's all gone back to
Julian what?
Looking after me.
Well, that's it.
And my contemplative, the contemplative part and the philanthropy for many people.
Yeah.
Has disappeared.
Well, I don't think it's disappeared. I think.
Maybe not disappeared totally. I mean, it's there for some people.
I definitely think a lot more could be done. I mean, there's a ton of agencies out there that either started as Christian organizations or still are, as far as, you know, World Vision, or there's a new one in, well, there's one that's in called Opportunity International that does microfinance, and then Mustard Seed, for example. But yeah, I think there's still a lot of philanthropy being done by the church, but when you think of a lot of the wealth that the church has, and when you think of what, half the world living on $2 or less than a day, there's still a huge disparity there, and yeah, a lot more needs to be done. But it's just a lot more complicated, because we're throwing tons of money all around the world, like Christian and non-Christian, to places like Haiti or other kinds of places, and sometimes we're making things worse. So is the money going to the right people? Are we having the right method? even with a homeless population, I think it's one of the most complicated populations out there, because it's far more than just poverty, and you have so many other things going on. And seeing that drugs are so much are just getting cheaper and cheaper every year, how do you combat that when people are have addictions? How do you move them forward until they figure that out? It's just very difficult. And then being on the street, you know, a lot of people are on the street because of mental illness, but a lot of people have mental illness because of being on the street. So you just, it's not just one factor, it's just all these factors that are just combining and complicating the matter. So, but thankfully, you know, I think we're talking about the Roman Empire and the Tulkoi, it's sort of this social void, this destitute population that just isn't even on the map. I think it's different in the sense that while maybe socially the homeless are kind of still a social void, because a lot of them are difficult to deal with. A lot of them are socially inappropriate and maybe just never learned good work ethic growing up. But on the other hand, at least I think the government has taken better strides in recent years of helping that. Like, the Alberta government's putting $100 million a year into like the 10-year plan to end homelessness. And there's a lot of money that we're accessing now to put people into housing. And, you know, we've gotten funding to build, like, an affordable housing tower. So I think that's changing for the better. But I think our fear is that they might say, well, we've put all this money into it, and after 10 years, we're not putting any more into it because we tried and we failed, so we're not going to help you guys out. So hopefully we can pull this off. Like, I think, obviously, we're always going to have problems like that. But it doesn't mean we shouldn't try. It doesn't mean we can mitigate the problems. And it's all about doing your homework and researching what's working and what's not working by other people who have tried. And I think agencies are working together more. There's been too much siloing, too many people doing their own thing, and not enough collaboration. So, but I think things are changing for the better. I think we're figuring it out.
I'm going to pick up on that just a little bit and push you a little bit on this. I paid attention to a couple social service agencies that are faith-based.
Mm-hmm.
Seems pretty clear to me that what faith-based means is they don't have to pay union standards.
Hmm.
Faith-based is a way of getting around union wages and getting around certain professional criteria. And what is so striking to me is that these organizations seek to mimic the public ways of doing it. So the way the state deals with the poor, with mental illness or what have you, that's the Bissell Center, for example, mm-hmm. or Catholic Social Services, the two that I know something about in Edmonton, they simply mimic what the state does. Now, if we look at back to Michael Ignatius, The Needs of Strangers, I mean, his point is that the great tragedy with the experiment in the social welfare system, the great tragedy is that it has institutionalized poverty, consequently building a bureaucracy and a set of professions around it, but it has isolated people in the process.
Yeah.
So when I listen to you talk about at least the way in which St. Gregory spoke about this, and Chrysostom and what have you spoke about it, they were very directly saying the issue isn't that they're poor. The issue is that you're not living with them.
Hmm.
They're not part of your life. You're not living life together. So, what are you doing at the mustard seed?
What are we doing? Well, that's a challenging quote. I hear.
I mean, is there anything in that, Jeremy? How do you see this?
Well, I think that is a great danger, and I think in some ways we have been guilty of that. But I think more and more we're recognizing the importance of community, and not just, like, you can't just put people through a program or service; it just doesn't work. They have to develop healthy relationships with others and with yourself, and you can't just, like, we have to help people integrate into the community, and that we can't do it by ourselves. We have to have the church community, the civic community help us. And we have a lot of volunteers come in, and that's, like, we couldn't do half of what we do without them.
But the volunteers coming in and doing something there is very different than the poor coming in and living with me.
Yeah, it is. And we're trying to push people out into the community, but that's easier said than done. And
I know it's easier said than done because I don't have any correlation.
Well, that's the thing. I remember someone who was talking about this at a church, and sometimes the answer is, well, didn't Jesus say the poor will always be with you? And the speaker retorted, he's like, okay, well then how often do you spend time with the poor?
Right.
You know, like, where are they? Do you know anyone? Do you know any of them? So, and that's very true. It's just,
right.
We all just want to hang around with people that are like us and that agree with us, think like us. And I think the internet kind of makes that too easy because we can sort of, you know, be friends with who we want to be and isolate the people we don't want to be with. And but it's very difficult. I mean, especially when, you know, some people are just socially awkward or you just have nothing in common. So where do you start? So then we just kind of gravitate towards people we grew up with or just, or whatever. And I think that's one of the great challenges. But that kind of needs to happen, I think, at a grassroots level. Like, we can't... I think we can do what we can, but, you know, we really need the community to stick with us and do that. And I think we often take example from the city of Portland, and they have a really successful kind of shelter system there. And but part of the reason why it's successful is because a lot of businesses in the downtown core really bought in, and they have really great programs because the community bought in. And with us, I think we have a ton of support from the local church and from the city of Calgary, but I think we need more. But I think on the microcosm level of actually people coming in, like, we had a Thanksgiving dinner on the weekend for some of the people that we moved out into transitional housing. We call it aftercare. And so we move them out into, like, low-income apartments, and then we have different caseworkers go out and visit them during the week just to make sure that things are going okay, and then also people that help them get involved with more leisure activities. And so we had this dinner, and it was wonderful. It was a wonderful event where staff and volunteers just had a meal together. Or, you know, we have a baseball team in the summer, and we just play baseball together. And it's like, it's a different level, because when they're out having fun, they kind of change because they're not kind of on the street. And we're different, and they realize that, you know, we're staff, but we're normal people too, and we can have a good time.
And you strike out.
Yeah, and we strike out.
Yeah.
So I think maybe just having fun together and just doing more, like, those kinds of events, I think, are very important. But unless we get community buy-in, we can't do a whole lot. Because it's NIMBYism, which is the acronym for not in my backyard. That's a big problem. Because it's always like, well, we don't want this shelter in my backyard. We want to gentrify this part of the city. So it's a challenge. But I think, yeah, if we have that ethic, you know, that we have a responsibility to the poor, and that comes from the center of our faith, and I think that does motivate a lot of people. But it's also about professionalism and having good standards and good management techniques too. There's that practical side to it. So,
thanks, Jeremy. Appreciate
you.
It. Just mention that this evening, same place, at 7, Stephen Martin, who's a professor of theology at King's in Edmonton, and who studied in South Africa and was involved with Archbishop Tutu and Nelson Mandela and what have you, has been tracking what's happened to the church as apartheid has come to an end, and has just come back from a sabbatical in South Africa, which he took, I think, largely to attend the World Cup, if I understand properly, is going to be speaking on Your Time Has Come, A Theological Trek to the Post-Apartheid Republic. I suspect he'll bring his, what's it called? His Wuwazela.
Oh.
So, if you can come, we're going to do it here. You're more than welcome. Thanks very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.